Lee Braver is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Hiram College in the United States. He is the author of A Thing of This World, A History of Continental Antirealism. Okay, Lee, what is continental philosophy and analytic philosophy, and what are their distinctions?
Well, the first thing to note about it is that it's a very contested division. People divide it up in all kinds of different ways, and some even deny that there is a significant distinction to be drawn. So there's no single agreed upon way to distinguish the two. To me, it's pretty undeniable that contemporary philosophy is divided up into these two different kind of camps, at the very least sociologically in terms of institutions. But there are some traditional ways to distinguish the two. The simplest, which means both easiest and also the one that leaves out the most, I think, is geographical. Mm-hmm. This is why one of them is called continental, because continental philosophy has traditionally been done on the continent of Europe, especially France and Germany. Whereas analytic philosophy, which is also sometimes called Anglo-American, has tended to be done in America and England. Now, there are exceptions, important exceptions, and there is work done on each in the other location, of course. But the primary canonical texts tend to have been written by the French and German figures for continental philosophy and British and American figures for analytic. So that's one way to divide it. A more substantive way to think about it, though, is kind of in terms of style. Mm-hmm. Analytic philosophers, and again, all of these are generalizations. There are lots and lots of exceptions to everything I'm going to say. But analytic philosophers tend to take science as really the paradigm of human knowledge, the most successful way humans have created to know the world. And therefore, philosophy, to whatever degree it can, should try to take that as a model. So, for example, analytic philosophers tend to treat problems, very specific, isolated issues or topics or puzzles. They try to break it down into its parts. That's where the word analytic comes from, to analyze it. And they try to focus in narrowly and specifically on particular components of a specific puzzle and try to incrementally advance knowledge by proposing a new solution to this one aspect or criticizing other solutions to it. And so it's very much on the model of science, and this lends itself to the style of short, very narrowly focused papers. Mm-hmm. And it tends to be in a number of people have made this comparison. It tends to also be done in the style of what Kuhn called normal science, where everyone pretty much agrees on the definition of the problem, on the terms to be used, on the kinds of moves that are legitimate. And I think that's why analytic philosophy tends to tout its clarity. It reads as clear because the people engaged in it have a lot of agreed on terms in common. For continental philosophers, in general, art, especially literature, history, the human sciences, the Geisteswissenschaften, these are taken to be the real models that philosophy should base itself on. These are the kinds of disciplines that can accommodate and respect the complexity of the human condition. So they tend to write these massive tomes that are, on Kuhn's taxonomy, revolutionary science, because they try to really redefine the whole way we approach the topics. And even they try to redefine, the great figures try to redefine even the way that we do philosophy at all.
Sure.
So continental philosophy tends to be in a kind of a continuously unstable revolutionary phase, with each new figure proposing new kinds of moves to make and new terms to explain them in. And that's why I think continental philosophy comes across as much more obscure. Because with each new figure, you almost have to learn a new vocabulary to understand what they're doing.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Just to clarify some points there. So as you were saying with analytic philosophy, where they deal with certain standard definitions and terms that are already in wide practice, usually from the sciences, there isn't as much semantic revolution as there would be in the continental tradition, and that's why, to a certain extent, topics such as causation and explanation figure heavily in analytic philosophy as opposed to continental philosophy.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that all the terms or even the majority of the terms are derived from science, but I think that there's much more agreement on which terms are appropriate to use in analytic philosophy, whereas it's almost part of the definition of a great philosopher for continental thinkers that they come up with really new approaches that demand new terms. And that's also, I think, why there is less of an idea of progress in continental philosophy. Mm. For analytic, again, basing itself on the model of science, we make these incremental advances, and we've learned things and solved puzzles that were not soluble by our predecessors. And so there's clear superiority. Russell, for example, thought that his method of logical analysis mm-hmm. enabled him to solve these problems, he says, about existence that have been confusing everyone since Plato. But now we can just put all those questions aside and put them to bed because we now have the right approach. You know, it's like we can stop doing alchemy now that we know how to do chemistry.
Sure, sure. We've got the correct methodology in certain respects.
Exactly. Sure. Whereas continental philosophers, you know, Heidegger once asked, what does it mean to say that Shakespeare has progressed upon Aeschylus? It just the notion of progress doesn't find a purchase on art. And so with each new philosopher coming up with very new approaches, you can't – it's much harder to compare them kind of apples to apples mm-hmm. and see, oh, yes, this person has solved a problem that person had. Now, I think you can do that. It just takes a lot of work. And that's one of the things that I tried to do in my first book, A Thing of This World, is come up with terms that we could apply to multiple continental philosophers to see how they're actually in conversation with each other.
Talk a bit about that first work of yours, and in terms of how you try to apply those issues there, and whether you see yourself falling in any particular camp or how you think you can integrate the two.
Well, I think of myself as a continental philosopher who is very interested in analytic philosophy as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't think there's, you know, that we should just give up the division, that it's meaningless. I don't think that we're all saying the same thing down deep. There are very important, significant differences, and I do align myself more with continental philosophy. I just think that we can be having conversations with each other. It's there are differences, but there aren't insurmountable barriers. That to me is just a mistake. It just takes a lot of work to get up to speed on the conversation that's been going on for 100 years, 200 years in the other camp. So in my first book, that's what I tried to do, is I tried to come up with a common vocabulary between, on the one hand, a number of analytic philosophers and a number of continental philosophers, and on the other hand, amongst the continental philosophers themselves. And I tried to show both that both these figures and both camps are talking about overlapping issues, namely anti-realism, and that the continental philosophers are each working on and developing the topics left to them by their predecessors. They're trying to, you know, revolutionize, as I said, but still it's always in reaction to and in context with their predecessor.
One main feature of your work in terms of trying to apply some of the aspects and issues from analytic philosophy and employing them with, whilst looking at continental philosophers, some of your work's done interesting stuff on realism and anti-realism, and traditionally in the 20th century realism and anti-realism has been associated with philosophy of science and analytic philosophy, usually, although the debates have moved on quite a bit, but it's traditionally in the sense of whether scientific theories do literally describe reality and truth, and whether we should accommodate unobserved entities as being theoretically true ontologically. But in your work, you're saying that realism and anti-realism is just as applicable to continental philosophy, and this is an issue that interests me and other people that have done continental philosophy, so please expand on those points if you could.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Anti-realism is a standard analytic topic in philosophy of science, but in other things as well. It's played a very important role in the origin of analytic philosophy, because Russell and Frege and Moore were very self-consciously and intentionally working in rebellion against Kant, the German idealists, the British idealists, that whole movement. They were trying to revive a kind of realism. For Frege and Russell, this meant a kind of an early Wittgenstein, a kind of logical realism. But they wanted to reject Kant's approach. And then after, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, then there started to be other figures who started to resurrect a kind of anti-realism, and on into the 60s and 70s, people like later Wittgenstein, Goodman, Putnam, Dummett, a whole bunch of figures. And what's interesting about this, something that Putnam has mentioned a number of times, is that anti-realism was founded basically by Kant. Now, if it was founded by Kant, he was the source of this idea, surely he's as influential on continental philosophy as he is on anti-realism, so I figured we should be able to find this same topic if we can develop the right kind of lens, the right kind of, you know, what I did was I set these theses of realism and anti-realism and looked for it in these continental philosophers. But Kant said that, I mean, philosophers have always believed that the mind has an impact on experience, whether it's the senses, whether it's beliefs, whether it's various other factors. They've always seen the mind as contributing something to experience, but they've always seen that as a negative. Whatever the mind contributes, well, that's not what's actually out there, and therefore that's not what's true, that's not what's real, and so we have to separate out what the world itself is like as opposed to what we have structured or organized or contributed to it ourselves, and only the former is true truth or real reality. Mm-hmm. What Kant did, what was so revolutionary about Kant's work, is that he took this basic idea, yes, in fact, the mind does contribute certain features to experience, but instead of preventing knowledge, he said, no, this is the one thing that enables us to have true knowledge. If the mind organizes experience in consistent ways, then we know we can always find these features in experience. We just have to limit our claims to the world as organized by us, in other words, phenomena. So for Kant, anti-realism was the solution, was the way to preserve science and genuine knowledge against Hume's challenge. And what I found when I tried to come up with some of the defining ideas of realism and anti-realism. And then I found these ideas throughout a number of very prominent continental thinkers. Hegel, Nietzsche, Heidegger, Foucault, Derrida were the ones that I emphasized. And so on the one hand, we can have dialogue. I mean, these figures who are rarely read in analytic circles are talking about the overlapping issues that people like Wittgenstein, Putnam, Dummett, and so forth are also talking about. And secondly, what I tried to show is that we can construct a kind of a coherent narrative arc throughout the history of continental philosophy among these very important figures, and see the ways that they adapted and changed Kant's ideas.
Essentially, there are overlapping themes between the analytic tradition and the continental tradition, because they're both, on a certain level, dealing with phenomena, experience, and the property and role of the mind.
Yep, yep. I mean, I think we're all children of Kant.
Yes, you know? Yes, yes.
Whitehead had that famous line, all of philosophy is but footnotes to Plato. Mm-hmm. I think the last 200 years has all been footnotes to Kant, personally.
Obviously, in continental Europe, he is basically regarded as one of the greatest philosophers since the ancient Greek world. I mean, he's been that prominent. Just to tie up in terms of the realism, so one of Hilary Putman's great works, which is Internal Realism, a definition that you also just lended there briefly about 5 minutes ago, was that realism is something that exists innately in itself and is external of the mind, but Kant comes along and says that we can never know the difference between the external experience and how we experience in our mind, so essentially we're always stuck in this prison of cognition, and that's how Kant is also the father of anti-realism in that respect.
Yes, but what's interesting about that way of putting it, I think that's all perfectly good. Of course, to me, the one word that sticks out on that definition is the word prison. As long as you preserve the idea of realism, as long as you preserve the idea of the world out there independent of us, what Kant called noumena, then we are, the only way that we can think of ourselves is stuck in a prison of our own making. That then this was Hegel's fundamental criticism of Kant. Hegel said that Kant gave us this wonderful phrase, an untrue form of knowledge. So that it's like knowledge, but it still isn't, it isn't real knowledge, because it's not knowledge of the way the world really is. And as long as we keep this distinction between the way the world is for us and the way the world is in itself, then the way the world is for us can't but be lesser, secondary, unreal, basically like a mass hallucination. It's shared, you know, that's nice, but it still isn't what the world really is. And so what one of the most prominent story arcs, so to speak, of 19th and 20th century continental philosophy is the progressive erosion of noumena. Kant kept this in his view. He kept this distinction between the world for us and the world in itself, which means that there was still this element of realism. We can't know the world as it is in itself, but we can know that it's there, and we can know some negative effects about it, that it's not spatial, it's not temporal, it's not causal, and so forth. What immediately happened right after he wrote this was that people started questioning his right to talk about this at all. I mean, this vestige of realism, his commitment to noumena, was seen, in my metaphor I use, as a metaphysical appendix. Right. It's something left over from a previous era, and it's not good. It's not doing us any good. It doesn't affect our practices in any way whatsoever, by definition. All it does is demote the reality we live in to a secondary reality and the knowledge that we achieve to a secondary form of knowledge. If we're talking about it, whatever we're talking about, we can only talk about it in the ways we have to talk about it. So what Hegel said was that Kant cannot actually be talking about the world in itself, even just to say it exists. To say that it exists is to make it an in itself for us, which sounds paradoxical, but what he means is that even talking about the world as it is independent of us, it's still us talking about it, still us positing it. It's still got to be shaped conceptually by the ways that we think. We just, you know, Kant said this, but he didn't fully live it out, that we can't step outside our own ways of thinking.
Sure, sure. And
go ahead.
Go ahead, Lee.
Well, and so this is what Hegel started trying to get rid of, the idea of noumen. Now, it's very hard to get rid of it because we still want to believe in a reality that's independent of us. It sure seems independent and so forth. And one of the things that I trace in that book is how all of these thinkers are kind of wrestling with this issue. How can we get rid of noumena while still recognizing and respecting the world's apparent independence and the fact that it was there before us and so forth?
But, I mean, it's a fascinating subject in itself. The aspects you're alluding to are German idealism, but especially some have also said that the fact that we can constitute a division between an external reality and our internal reality, and how we basically process some form of external reality in ourselves internally, that presupposes by definition that there's still some form of external reality, and that's also been challenged by other idealists who sometimes posit the notion that everything is just pure idealism with no external reality or materiality, which is a dying breed now in philosophy, but it was once proposed. Now, Lee, in terms of tracking... Let me just say one quick thing about that. Go ahead.
That's kind of the traditional idealism, that's Berkeleyan idealism. I don't think that's the anti-realism that I'm talking about, because they're not going to deny that there's a world independent of us. What they're going to challenge is our ability to coherently form the notion of this. Okay. So that's very cryptic, I know, but go ahead.
So it still assumes an external reality. The problem is how we process that ourselves from that external form. So that's fine, although it's cryptic, but very fundamental, as you say. Now, we've discussed and you've elaborated how there are overlapping themes in terms of realism and anti-realism, both analytic tradition and the continental tradition. So in your work and your ideas, how does anti-realism relate to post-structuralist philosophy and the role of discourse, which becomes very prominent in the 1960s and the 70s with Derrida and Foucault, but also in American philosophy, probably most notably someone like Richard Rorty. So if I could get your thoughts on anti-realism and its relation to the role of discourse and post-structuralist philosophy.
Well, I see continental anti-realism as kind of reaching its climax in Heidegger's later work. And my take is that Heidegger's later work is kind of the next major bend in the river, the next major phase after Kant's work. Because with his later work for Heidegger, all, you know, being just is appearing. It's what manifests itself to us. And he really stringently rejects talking about any kind of reality that's wholly independent of us or external, what he calls the clearing. And so what we want to talk about, when we talk about reality, we're talking about what appears to us. And this is really the approach of phenomenology, which I think Heidegger kind of radicalizes in his later work. And for me, this later work is the source that postmodernism and post-structuralism comes out of, to a large degree. And you can find quotes by Foucault and Derrida where they'll say things roughly like that about just how important Heidegger was to them and he's really kind of the seminal figure for this for these movements. And what we see in people like Foucault and Derrida is that they're also they're talking about when they want to talk about a subject. For instance, when Foucault talks about subjectivity, what is it like to be a subject? He talks about subjectivity only insofar as it happens in historical actuality. He's only going to talk about sexuality, for example, in the forms that it's actually taken, rather than kind of contrasting those with a sexuality in itself or some kind of true essence of subjectivity. So here again, we have the restriction of what we're going to talk about to what manifests itself in experience, what actually happens in the phenomenal empirical world. For Derrida, he wants to talk about language as it actually happens. And he consistently criticizes philosophers for ignoring what's actually happening in language in favor of what they kind of think must be happening in language, these a priori sort of assumptions about the way language has to be operating. And so they're talking about these phenomena in the way they actually happen and the way they come to manifestation. And they're talking about, and they're, so they're analyzing how they come about, right? How does, for instance, modern subjectivity what makes it possible? In Kantian terms, what are the conditions for the possibility for the modern soul in Discipline, Foucault's Discipline and Punish, for example? What are the conditions for the possibility for modern sexuality in History of Sexuality? What enables us to have language that communicates with each other for Derrida? And so, and for all of these figures, one of the main conditions, one of the best ways to analyze all of this phenomena is in terms of discourse. Discourse to some degree, it's not entirely, but to some degree takes the place of Kant's transcendental subject. For Kant, if we're to ask how does causality happen, for example, the answer is, well, the transcendental subject, it has this concept of the understanding, and it structures experience so that one event causes another if it meets certain requirements. For Heidegger, he's going to say things about how language forms phenomena, that all that experience, he wouldn't like putting it this way, but experience is linguistic all the way down. And so language plays a very important role in forming and shaping how we experience the world and therefore in what can happen. And discourse plays a similar role, especially in Foucault's early work, in his archaeological phase. There he looks at, the word archaeology, he says, doesn't come from digging up arcade, doesn't come from digging up foundations. He based it on the archive. So what he thought at that point in his career was that what is said about things, the kinds of statements that go, that are accepted as true, are the ones that determine the reality of the phenomenon. So what is sexuality? Well, it's, we don't look just directly at the body for sexuality. We have to look at what passed as true discourse about sexuality. What did people say that was accepted as true? And he examines sexuality by means of the different types of statements that could be said about it. So at one point you could talk about sexuality in terms of sin. Then in, you know, the late 19th, 20th centuries, we start talking about it in terms of normality and health. And again, if we're an anti-realist, this doesn't mean that there's some sexuality in itself, that one of these is right and one of them is wrong. Instead, when our experience of it changes, sexuality changes. The types of things that we can say about sexuality changes, so sexuality changes. Right? And so in this way, we're still in the wake of Kant. We're still talking about something like the constitution of phenomena, but there's no contrast with noumena anymore, and there is a historical fluctuation of them. You know, for Kant, there's only one set of concepts and forms of the intuition. Once Hegel initiated a historical succession of different concepts and things like that, then everyone after that agreed with that. So for later Heidegger, it's the epochs of metaphysics. And for Foucault, discourse changes fundamentally from period to period. So he can talk about the creation, the birth and death of man, meaning that the modern form of subjectivity started at a certain point when discourse changed, and it ended at a certain point.
With this actually in mind, it boils down to a fundamental question that I want to get your thoughts on in terms of anti-realism and realism in itself, because essentially the way Foucault operates with discourse, as you were saying, for example, sexuality is one of them. Another one was sanity, which is these things don't exist intrinsically in themselves as in a realist form, but we can study them, how they manifest themselves in discourse, and then how they become propagated as versions of truth. And we see this change throughout history in terms of what constitutes sexuality, sanity, justice, and political and social equality. Now, on that hand, that is purely dealing with human affairs, what the Europeans would call human sciences, and now it's kind of branched out across the world in vaguer aspects in terms of social sciences that deal with quantitative research methodologies. But Derrida, as you were saying, reduces all experience to forms of language, and now that's going to have a prominent impact in the way we talk about scientific theories that refer to observed phenomena with language, but this language in itself can also transcend international languages. So no matter what language you speak, you can essentially all agree on what a particle and an atom is. And I wanted to get your thoughts on how this divide between how issues that relate to human subjectivity and subjective conceptual notions such as right, wrong, justice and equality, how that plays in when natural scientists in an analytic tradition or philosophers in the analytic tradition say that this is all just irrelevant because when I say that this material object such as an electron and a particle exists, it really does exist regardless of what someone like Derrida is saying. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I wouldn't say that for Derrida nothing exists beyond language. I think that's a understanding of him, but I think that's a misunderstanding of him. He famously says there's nothing outside the text.
Yes.
It's this very famous line.
Yes, you can see it, yes.
I'm pretty sure he regretted saying it because it got thrown in his face over and over and over again. But what he means by that isn't that nothing exists but books, nothing exists but words. What he means, and he says this very clearly in Limited Ink, where he has this debate with Searle, he says that all of our experience is mediated by language and knowledge and beliefs. Right? So to say there's nothing outside the text doesn't mean that I can never get outside language, but it means that even when I'm dealing with the world, I'm dealing with it in terms of linguistically structured categories. Mm-hmm. So let's apply this to science, right? Does an electron exist or not? Well, sure. I mean, Derrida would never deny that electrons exist. What he would point out, and this is something that, for instance, Bruno Latour does a lot of work on now, what he would point out is that in order to say this both meaningfully and truthfully, that an electron exists, requires a tremendous amount of other beliefs. I mean, you don't just walk down the street and bump into an electron. You have to set up extremely complicated machinery to detect it, And then and the machinery is based on all kinds of other beliefs about what exactly these machines are doing, what the results mean, and what the thing is that shows up. So Darren, I wouldn't deny any of that is true. What he would say is, and this is the exact same thing that Foucault says and that Heidegger says, is that truth is located within a whole, and Quine also says this, so it's not just wacky continental philosophers. Quine is very clear about this. To say something like an electron exists can only be meaningful and can only be true in the context of a whole bunch of other beliefs. So those machines detecting the electron have to be interpreted. We have to know what exactly they're doing, what they're detecting, what these results mean, and that rests on a huge body of other beliefs. And those beliefs rest on others and so on and so forth. Now, these have been tested and have lots of good reasons to believe them. He's not saying, therefore, we chuck the whole thing. All he's saying is that it must take place in a context of a whole lot of else that's going on. It's not this immediate face-to-face encounter with the world that just tells us what's real.
To a certain extent, you can see that the ghost of Kant there emanates itself in some of the work of Derrida. But even that to a certain...
Absolutely.
Sure. Even that to a certain extent, obviously, there's been a lot of work done in the sociology of science in terms of these integrated belief systems that everyone operates in the Western world. But wouldn't you say that even that saying that these operate within a wider context of beliefs, even that may make some realists nervous?
Oh, sure. Okay. It would. But I think the important point... first of all, to me, it seems pretty hard to deny. Mm. So I think it's right. But the second point is what Derrida is saying is a lot less outrageous than is often portrayed. It's not I agree with you. It's not that therefore he's just a realist and there's no problem here and everyone will just say, okay, fine, we agree with him. Mm. But he is a reasonable conversant. He's someone who's making arguments, who's making reasonable points that I actually think are true, but I don't see how you can say that they're crazy, which I've seen many people say they're crazy. And he's not just playing tricks. He's making arguments. He's making good points. And like you just said, and as I try to show in my book, they become much more reasonable when we see them in the philosophical context, when we see him as carrying on what Kant did. I think most analytic philosophers, even if they disagree with Kant, mm-hmm. would find him a reasonable thinker who's putting forth reasoned positions. I mean, Derrida is working in this tradition, as I said, many of these thinkers are. And we can talk with him. We don't have to, we shouldn't dismiss him without reading him, as so many people do.
Unfortunately, yes. Well, Lee, if I could just get you to summarize some of your points that you've raised in this interview in terms of how this all plays into different conceptions of reality and truth. Also, your upcoming work in this area and what you think some other future developments may be in this area as well, Lee.
Well, to summarize it briefly, when we talk about the world, it's always us talking about the world. Mm-hmm. We can't remove ourselves from that. So it's not that the world disappears and is just entirely absorbed into our ideas, as perhaps Berkeley might have thought, mm-hmm. but it's that, McDowell has this wonderful phrase where he says we can't see the world and our contribution sideways on, where we can separate the two. We can only deal with the world that we can have some access to, some experience of, and that access means that it involves our ways of thinking about it. And that's how I understand anti-realism. It's not the denial of reality. It's saying that the only world we can talk about is the world that we talk about. And that brings along our categories, our taxonomies. It makes all in itself into an in itself for us. Mm-hmm. And that means that truth can't be correspondence to this wholly independent realm. Kant took that off the table. Mm-hmm. Truth is, as Foucault said, gave the title of my book, a thing of this world. Mm-hmm. Truth is our attempts to know the world, and it's always our attempts. And so these factors that can seem contingent and extraneous to knowledge, these sociological factors, for example, they can't be external to it because there's no purity for them to be external to. It's always these aren't restrictions on our getting knowledge. They're what enable us to know anything in any way at all. Mm-hmm. As far as future developments, there is this interesting new movement called speculative realism that's trying to move past all of anti-realism, but without ignoring its lessons. They're trying to turn the page on Kant's legacy without, but still learning from him, not kind of trying to go before him and forget everything that he's done. And this is very interesting. I've read a little of it, and I'm working right now on what I call transgressive realism, which is a focus on experiences that kind of violate or overwhelm the categories that we use to understand experience. So it's still a reality that we're in contact with, but it's also one that doesn't fit into the ways that we think about it. I've been thinking a lot about those kinds of experiences lately.